So why Camelot? Why choose that subject?
That's a good question. I think at the time, you really felt that there hadn't been any... I mean, there were movies done about Camelot, Sword in the Stone, things like that, but there wasn't anything ever done in the way that we wanted to do it, and we thought that it was a great setting, and we really liked the values and the themes at the time, from the time period, with truth and justice and valor, and we just felt that it was really right for this kind of thing, plus the element of magic.
Yeah.
That was in that
and
time.
And action. It provided a lot of action. Fast-paced movie.
And also, Frederick could probably talk a little more about it, but when we first started conceiving the story, we wanted to go back to a Camelot that was not the Camelot you think of or that you've seen before with the shiny armor. We wanted the grittier... I mean, obviously it's animation, so it's not going to be totally realistic, but...
It was Celtic, back to nature, you know. We conceived the castle almost coming out of the ground with the stone and all that in the forest, so we wanted to give it a different look. There's been a lot of great movies about Camelot, so...
In live action?
Yeah, in live action. Why try?
It was the first animated.
Well, no, Sword in the Stone.
Sword in the Stone.
But
that's almost...
Yeah, I didn't...
That's
I wasn't
way before our movie. It's almost for Sword in the Stone.
It was all about Arthur.
And later we go after, you know, it's beyond that. And you've seen the movie, so it's not really about Arthur or Arthur's story. It's Kaylee's story.
We never really set out to tell a story of Arthur, certainly not the lifelong Guinevere myth that everyone thinks of. We really liked the time period and the setting and the ideals. I mean, I think that was the major thought behind it, was really the ideals and the sense of magic that happened in that time, that people, when they think of the legend, they think of sort of magic.
Did you conscious effort to go after the young girl market?
Well, it was a conscious effort.
I don't know, but the book that the movie's based on provided that was the story. We didn't stick literally to the book, but
no, we're quite story, far from the book.
Yeah.
But the heroine,
but the basic
from that
story is there. It was about a young girl wanting to be a knight, and that's the story that was chosen. So we kept that.
I mean, ironically, I would say that neither of us think that it's only a young girl's story. So because there's so much action and there's also, we love the character of Garrett as a new type of hero with, you know, and the whole point really, pardon me, of this film is that the unlikeliest of heroes can win the day, and that pretty much anyone can, and that was sort of the ideals of the time, that if you follow your honor and your truth and your, you know, sense of justice, you can prevail. And so the group that we have, which is Kaylee, who's a girl who, of course, in those days, girls didn't do these things, a blind young man, and then, of course, the two-headed dragon, who's the misfit runt of their group.
I must say that I never felt doing it like a girl's movie or anything. It was an action-adventure with songs in it, and if the girl needed to get on a horse and jump over that ledge, she was going to do it. If it was her or Indiana Jones, it didn't matter. It just, you know... So.
Seem to be almost self-consciously egalitarian and self-consciously politically correct in some ways. You guys are trying to go out on it and make sure that every misfit character was portrayed as being an equal participant?
No, not really.
Yeah, no.
It was just organic to the... No, it was pretty organic to the story, actually. It wasn't there.
The pacing thing is an interesting point, because obviously we tell movies in our modern day thinking in the 90s, and we think in that, in those terms, as people, certainly as a woman, I think that way because I don't consider myself any different than anyone else. So when you're telling stories and making films, even though they're set in an older time period, other films I've been involved with before this that were live action films that had, one particular one had a female heroine, but we approach it in the same way. You just, as a modern filmmaker, that's the way your mind thinks. So...
We
weren't consciously trying to be PC.
We just tried to do the right thing. Sometimes people would suggest the happy ending and changing things around. We'd go, no, you can't do it. It's not because of PC. It'd be murder if you did.
Well, Garrett, the blind thing with Garrett. I mean, we did not want him to get his sight back. And I don't know if keeping him blind would be considered PC or making him. But we didn't feel that was appropriate to the character. So.
You can't say a whole movie, look, this guy's doing all this stuff his own way, but at the end, he's going to get his sight. It's just kind of, you know, it doesn't work like that. So it wasn't really consciously PC. It was just trying to do whatever was right.
How much did that movie change over the 3 years it took?
Well, a lot. It definitely changed about 100% from what was started with. So, yeah, I think it took us about a year and a half before the script was all done, and we said, this is the movie we're making.
Yeah, I would say it was probably, we physically made this movie in a year and maybe three or four months.
Yeah.
I mean, including post.
Yes.
Including post, it was a very fairly short schedule. So that was started sometime toward the end of 96, sort of really started hitting its stride around December of 96. And it was right around that time that we had a script that we were happy with. So everything prior to that was different machinations of getting to that point.
Yeah.
And then once we started going, that was the movie we knew we were making. And we didn't veer off of that enough.
100% change in what movie?
No, not 100%.
Well, 100% I mean is that the very first script that was done, Prince's Knight, and all that was literally thrown away.
Okay, you're talking about the development.
I was on it from the beginning, so if you ask me, I once had a script in front of me that literally was taken and put on a shelf and never looked at it again.
There were incarnations of this thing. Before I even came to Warner Brothers, actually, there were... It was called Princess Knight, and it wasn't, I guess Vera Chapman's book was purchased at the time, but there were many stories in Vera Chapman's book, and the first person who had an idea to do it took a direction on the stories that was, we went back to that book and said, no, we want to take this direction. So originally, but none of those people are, I mean, there were studio executives that, this was like before anybody was even there, before even like Michael Laney was there. Forever ago.
Yeah.
So
well, I was there very early, so you'll get different answers from us.
At
number 50.
At the whole company.
And then the company.
The whole division.
So you got there what time?
I got there, it was like June 94 or 93. I don't even know it.
Okay.
I know it was right after Land Before Time.
94. Because I got there in 95.
And I started there, and Prince's Knight, as it was then called, was one of my first assignments. I started developing some scenes and do drawings and all that. And I went off it because I had a project myself. That I
what was the project? What was that project?
That I want to do? That was called Menahunes back then. It's now called Shangri-La. I don't know if
it's still called
Menahunes.
It's still
Menahunes.
Is it tiring to work so long on one?
Very. It's very tiring.
Get discouraged sometimes or what?
Yeah. Sometimes you do. But I must say that it's ups and downs. It's sort of like real life. It's like real life all in 3 years. You know,
The schedule, the actual production schedule that we ended up with when so much of our time was spent developing it, I would say from the time it was greenlit, the first 18 months of that was development. And most of the artists went off to do Space Jam, which was great for Quest because they were busy on Space Jam, so we were still working on the script. So by the time, like I say, toward the end of 96, it was when we really started production, real production. It was such a, from that point to now, it was 7 day weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, we were there 20 hours a day sometimes.
It's all worth it though, when we're doing our test screening, so we're sitting in the midst of all the kids.
Okay.
When they're laughing and they're all glued to the screen, then you're saying, okay.
What was the first test screening?
When?
Yeah.
A couple months ago.
Yeah.
Actually, no. We weren't testing it to, you know, the truth is, you just test movies because you always do it. And I think for us, it was nice to just know what was working, what wasn't working as far as timing. But we did nothing.
No,
I disingenuous, but nothing wasn't working. We were very happy. So
The only option we had was cut, and we didn't. Actually,
we didn't cut anything according to the test screening.
We made some little nips ourselves. Remember that? But that's it.
Literally like 2 seconds. I mean, three deep scenes.
Do audiences from different parts of the country react the same differently?
We've shown it over here. Remember New York.
You know what was very interesting? The two test screenings that we had in Los Angeles that went really well were very what probably the LA version of the Midwest might be, sort of middle class
suburbia.
And when we showed it in New York, we showed it once. It wasn't a test screening, but it was a screening that some people came to, and it was all urban. And the reaction was probably even greater from the urban audience, which shocked us because we never really expected it to play to that audience. But
yeah.
But usually you've run maybe mainly a test screening before for other productions or
me personally?
Yes. So do they react differently?
To be honest with you, all the test screenings I've done have always been on the West Coast, Seattle and LA. And they were live action movies, but so I really couldn't answer whether different parts of the country reacted differently.
I wonder how strong you can rely on test screening to change anything.
You know what? And that's a good question. I don't think you can rely on a test screening at all. It'll give you a little bit of a feel, but those are 300-400 people, and that's it. They can never be representative of. If you make a movie and it's for international release, there's no way you can. You mean if there's big mistakes in it, or they don't understand?
Yeah,
it's
if they don't understand.
Great. They don't understand it. That's how you get feedback. People start saying, I didn't get this, I didn't get that. But if you don't have those, how good your movie is going to be, you don't know. I'm even from a whole other culture, so I see the movie differently than you see it. I mean, we all look at it from a different point of view.
And in animation, there's not a lot. Most people change once they test it because you're so close to your end date. But in live action, you can learn a lot from test screenings. You can see where an audience reacts to something, where they don't. But as filmmakers, you have to stick to your vision. So you can't second guess yourself if you think an audience is asking for something different than what you believe in. But of course, in this movie, it just wasn't an issue.
Focus for a bit of a reality check.
Yeah. To see, you know,
make
how
sure they got it, that it was clear and simple. I mean, that it was easy to understand. That's about, you know. I mean, actually, there was a joy. Everything was a joy because the jokes, they laughed and they got
actually,
sad when they didn't.
Things that we did not expect people to get. We were amazed. It was.
You mean like the acne thing on the magic potion?
It was actually earlier than that. It's like the very first time you see the chickens, the audiences are getting these characters, and the chicken that becomes Blaybeak. Usually, you would think maybe not until he becomes Blaybeak do people really understand it, but Henrietta, the wife, who sort of henpecks the chicken Blaybeak, and the audiences get that every time. The first time you see them on screen.
Or kids getting why cousins shouldn't marry.
Oh, well, they just laugh because the parents laugh.
I know, but if you think about it, I mean, you know.
Going from live-action films to creating animated features, especially the first big animated feature for Warner Brothers in this era, you find the studio had a stronger involvement in the creation of film.
Mm-hmm.
Watching every step of the way.
Yeah, they were very involved. The great thing about Warner Brothers, though, is that of all the studios that I've been involved with, they know how to support their filmmakers. This is not to say other studios don't, but there's a Warner brand, a way of doing things, and it's quite nice as a filmmaker because we got tons of support for the film, and they obviously were very involved because they're very, you know, they started this big division, there's a big investment, they care a lot about it, but they have tremendous respect for filmmakers.
They let you do your thing.
Yeah.
They are involved, they'll check you, they'll check in every week and have meetings, but they let you do your thing. Nobody comes into the editing room and goes, I get that out.
Yeah.
Nobody ever tried that or did that.
Yeah.
So their involvement doesn't increase any respect. They don't sit on that just the process at all, as far as
not on the problem.
Money.
They're very involved creatively. It's just the manner in which they do it is a more supportive than dictatorial way.
Okay.
They're very supportive, and they it's a partnership.
Yeah.
They will tell you
that this costume for this character won't work, but they won't tell you how to fix it or what costume they want. You'll just come up with other ones, and you get.
Or if you think it works and you can make your case, you'll win a lot of times. It's a collaborative process, and particularly something like animation. I mean, all films are so collaborative, it takes so many people to make them, but in animation it takes 3 or 4 times the number in a regular film. So, you know, you have to be used to the collaborative thing.
But even as far as you felt they had more involvement in a live-action film that you worked with in the past because it was new thing for them, as far as being maybe a little worried that...
Actually, that's a tough thing to say because it depends on the live-action film. I've made a couple movies at Warner's, and depending on what the film is, they're more or less involved. Depending on the size of the film, their expectations for the film, and how much help you need. And sometimes, I mean, there was a certain point in this film where we really turned to them for certain decisions and to help us sort of say, okay, should we go left, should we go right? So it entirely depends on the movie. But the involvement is not intrusive involvement at this company, which is...
your predecessor's producer of the film, Why did you leave?
You know, I couldn't answer that because...
I was... Did you quit or was you fired?
I honestly don't know. I was not part of that decision. My assumption is that most of the people, you know, in a new division, a lot of people come in early and a lot of people stick around and some people don't. You find the fit. And my experience and the people who are not around, they felt that it wasn't creatively. You know, Warner's is, contrary to what happened with the marketing person recently, it's not a place that's a big firing place. As an idealistic thing for Warner's, my experience there has always been that they really like to give people the chance to find their place. And a lot of times, and they're so respectful there that a lot of times people will say, I'm just not happy here, it's not working for me, and they're gracious. And even people they don't want to leave, if you're desperate to get out, they're gracious too. So I say that as Warner's as a whole. I've always found that to be, I mean, Bob and Terry have been there for, they're the longest regime. It's not a place that likes to have a revolving door.
There was a lot of, you know, rumors and dissension on the set in '96, you know, when Bill Croyer, I think it was Bill Croyer, like, left, I believe, in the summer of '96.
I wouldn't say there was dissension, really. I think it was, and Bill and Sue, I haven't talked to Sue in ages, but I have a great relationship with Bill, and they really, particularly Bill, felt that it wasn't going in the direction that he was comfortable with and just didn't want to be, I mean, parted ways fairly amicably, as far as I was concerned. So,
We never stopped the process.
No.
We just kept going. There were two other people that felt that they didn't want to make this movie like this, with this point of view.
I mean, that's a lot to do with the incarnations of the story that we were talking about, that the very first, I mean, it changed many different times, and at a certain point, people sign on to something and are thinking of it in one way, and then ultimately, as it grows, and it's certainly been in my experience because I've worked in development for so many years, things just shift, and either it's still your vision and you believe in it and can execute that, or you just, I mean, it happens all the time. Actors will drop out of projects if it's just not going in there.
It's also what, we got a green light in, what, in 95?
Yeah.
Or something in May. But usually when you get a green light, you have an approved script and you start working, and that's the vision everybody signs on, and you agree or not agree to make this movie. We didn't have that. So we kept working and working and trying things.
We greenlit to development, actually.
Yeah. And then once we got to that development, we had a script that the studio liked and we all liked, and then sort of the teams shifted because some people really liked them, some people said, you know what, this is not for me. I'm going to move on. And that's what happened.
Could you direct real people?
Yeah.
Well,
I did.
Like the same, like the voices? Or
But I did some live action. I did a Sony short, which was mainly live action, and we also shot some live action for Disney. Yeah.
But all the voice talent, you know, we come in the studio and record, and Frederick directs the performance. So it's just like directing live action, except that they don't have a set. So sometimes it's more difficult for the actors because you have to, if I can speak to you, the director, create the scenario for them without benefit of sets and other actors, and sometimes two actors can come in and record together.
Yeah. But and then we shot all the dance numbers and the fight scenes.
Kenny Ortega choreographed the dance numbers.
Yeah, so we had a sound stage and then film crew and all that. It's not too different. Once you have a vision in your head and being an artist and coming from a graphic background, you just sort of learn how to communicate to each member of your crew what you want to get on that piece of film. And once you learn how to communicate that to the different crew members, that's making the movie. Whatever's in your head needs to end up on that negative, you know? Yeah. Also, I went to school for that. I went to regular film school. So.
I noticed that the press kit didn't have the guy who was the lead, animator for Merlin, Sir Lionel, and the Griffin.
Those are parts. Yeah, they weren't because the parts were initially very small, and we had a cleanup crew that was assigned to them so that everything would look the same. Actually, to be quite honest, I think to give him credit, Mike Wing actually took the Griffin for his time.
Mike Wing's wonderful. He was the lead animator on Aiden.
And he obviously focused most on Silverwing. But he had some time left over because he worked really fast on that. And he did the Griffin also. And I believe one of the main people on Arthur was, we had some scenes in England, and Russell Hall did those, and then Lenny Graves did them over here. Arthur. Merlin was also Mike Wayne.
Oh yeah, it was.
That's right. Mike's really good and really fast, as you can tell. Who else did you?
Lionel.
Actually, Crystal did Lionel.
She did.
Yes, because she started out experimental animation with Gary. We didn't have the voice yet. We didn't have the voice for Lionel.
But we didn't credit them as such on the film because their main assignments were the other characters.
Okay, and what happened to Christopher Reeve?
Well, Christopher Reeve did his whole part for Arthur, and from the beginning, before he recorded anything, which was actually right after, that was a year after the accident, but he was still in trying to get better and working on everything. He really wanted to do it. We recorded the whole part, and we set up from the beginning that he would listen to everything, make sure that he liked it and that it was what he wanted to do, and then decide if we could use it or not.
Well, but before and that, the part, what happened was we expanded the part, and he took in the gloaming to direct, and we had all these extra lines to record, and he didn't want to do it.
No, well, we did. We went out. He was actually on the set. He was in pre-production. We went out to his house and all that. I think the decision was that he could only focus on so much. He had the new movie starting, and in order to do Arthur, he wanted to re-record part of what he already did, and with a few extra lines, it became too much. And he just said, you know what, I can do this in a few years, but right now I'm not ready. I don't feel comfortable with this. So that's what happened. But he was great. I thought he sounded great. You know, we ran those things. We actually animated to it. But, you know, we owe that to him that he would be in charge of that. And any actor would. I mean, if they have the time to come back and either loop it or redo the scenes, we couldn't do that with Chris. So.
So when did you decide on the title? It was Princess Nine, and then it was Quest for the Grail, and then it was the Magic Sword, and then Quest for the Calendar.
The Magic Sword is
the international title, and that's a recent thing. And apparently, the translation of some languages in Camelot, I guess in French, it's the Junkman.
Yes.
Yes. Camelot.
Just knighted at the end. What would be the translation in French? Professor Zimbabwe.
No, I wouldn't know.
Because you have the just married, you know, the mm-hmm. Just knighted.
It'll be interesting what they come up with, because we also shot a version with it
textless.
Left open, textless, so
okay.
Whatever they'll write in.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just saying,
yeah, so the international title is The Magic Sword, Quest for Camelot is the full international title. The other titles you mentioned...
The Grail went out when the script went out.
Well, at one point, they were going after the Grail instead of the sword, so... That's why we had that title. And it was pretty much when we shifted direction and started locking in our story. So it would have been toward the end, fall of 96, I think, was when we locked in the title.
And Princess Knight was the very original thing I talked about. That was completely...
Yeah, we never were going to use that title.
So, yeah. Isn't that the... Oh, no, that's not the name of the book.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it was like Quest for Camelot for some of the day.
Then it was probably right at that time that when it became that. That summer was when we decided they were going to go after Excalibur. It was the end of that summer. It was, when Feather and Cyber came on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the writing teams.
Fine. So that was right after Coriolis. Right?
Yeah, right mm-hmm. after that. And that's when we started locking into the story we wanted to tell. And came up with that title. Although I have to say, the title came before I would say the script was entirely finished.
Uh-huh.
But we knew that that was the direction.
What was the budget?
much less than what was reported.
You mean it's not more than Titanic?
It's so not even close to Titanic. I mean, and you know, a good enough amount to have high quality. But also good enough amount for the studio to make the money back. So, you know, and I will probably say that we came in on budget.
I also
after a couple years of misstarts, was not easy.
I heard it was also at one point for the PG-13.
Never been PG, just G.
It was always G.
Well, it was only it was never an issue until we showed the ratings board, and they immediately gave it the G.
And the ratings saw it early on. They actually saw it the first time.
Yeah, we showed
on
them
board,
early rough
and
rough.
It was all in reels, and they gave it a G right there.
Well, they thought it when I saw it. When you give it their,
but they said it would be G, and then when they saw Pencil Test and they saw color, they said, yep.
But it possibly, you know, because we didn't want to make an entirely soft movie, and I think Frederick directed very much like a live-action film. It's very action-oriented. It moves a lot. That because of the action element, I don't know, maybe someone might have thought, could we get the G? But it was not no mm-hmm. contest. I mean, they gave it to G.
Right. We have time for one more question. And this, you know, unlike our normal ones, we're going to move the press people rather than the interviewees because we can't move David Foster.
For me?
I'm reading
a lot of scripts.
So maybe they'll sing for you.
I'll talk something English or the animation.
I'm talking to Warren about one thing, yeah. But I'm talking around
the actual animation. He can answer that better. There were a lot of backgrounds. The round table room was built in the computer, and the ogre, of course, is computer. The question was, how much was CG?
Ooh, CG, yes. All the wagons, all the reference for horses and oxen. Ogre, and the round table room, the ring of stones is built. That's about it. There is no such thing as what CG.
Right.
CG touches every scene, and digital touches every scene, and traditional touches it all. It's very odd to say that's a digital scene.
But of what we designed in CG were the
like the ogre we designed. I mean, for me, it was important to make him fit within the scenes. Actually, at one point you don't see him, and he moves, and all of a sudden there he is. I think I like that scene. It's very successful to blend the two medium because the whole background was hand painted, and the ogre was 3D. I think they did a great job at that, and that will probably show in Iron Giant.